be more complicated than that.
Like, I definitely feel like it's such a privilege to deeply love people who don't love themselves. Because I've been in that space, right? And so, and it's hard. It's a hard thing to remember all the time that, like, I am beautifully created and I am loved. And so being able to, like, have that in the room, especially with folks who are really getting those systemic messages from elsewhere that that's not the case, I think that's where the energy comes from for me.
Hi, this is Doug Harrison, and welcome to The Heartburn. Three words: share, subscribe, review. Share, subscribe, review. Share, subscribe, review. These are so important to us right now. When you share or especially subscribe right now, it's worth 10 times of subscribing to any other podcast right now. It makes a huge difference as to whether people will ever catch on and listen or not, and I'd really love for that to happen. Today is just the first part of two episodes with Sarah Kapostasy. I felt like what she was saying was so important. One, what she does without youth here in Austin, Texas is so phenomenal. I wanted to let that and her, the way she illuminates the queer and trans experience is so helpful. I wanted to catch all of it. But it's so formative to hearing the second part of her own story and her spiritual journey. So please tune into there and enjoy it. And if you're anything like me, it will spark an awareness of some of your own passions. So listen as Sarah speaks. So let's start with actually just learning. So I am, I'm one of the people who puts the G in LGBTQIA+. One of the things that, actually I was watching an episode of Queer Eye the other night and I really appreciated it because they sat around saying, we have no idea what trans experience really is. So I'm one of those guys. I have very little to say about LBTIA stuff. So what I wanted to say is just let me invite you that if my language can use some tweaking, please do that for the sake of us and for the listeners because it's super helpful. It's a nice place for us to be able to do that. And if I happen to get something right that you notice and it's useful to the listeners, then do that also because I think there's just a lot of people who want to do better, and there's not a lot of safe spaces to experience that. So please, thank you for being here. And Sarah, tell me, first of all, just what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis? We know you are at a wonderful organization in town called Out Youth here in Austin, Texas. And what does that life look like for you?
Yeah, thanks for having me, by the way. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. And thanks for that kind of invitation to talk about or tweak language or provide constructive feedback. I think that's so important. I think, you know, language is incredibly powerful, especially when we're thinking about minority identities. So I appreciate that. And it's something close to my heart just because of the work I do day to day at Out Youth.
Right,
so
right.
What I love about my job is every day is a little bit different. And that just kind of suits my personality a little bit. I like a lot of variety. So basically, we offer a variety of services at Out Youth to support LGBTQ+ folks. So I'm head of our clinical services department. So what that looks like is I work with clinicians who provide counseling services. So we provide individual counseling services. Right now we have about 80 clients that we serve. In individual counseling.
That's a lot more than I thought even.
Yeah. We've been able to grow in the last couple of years just because the need is so great. And that's one of the struggles of my job, honestly. I've been dealing with that a lot this week, actually, is that, you know, our capacity just in terms of staff and in terms of our physical building is just, it's really hard for it to meet the need that we see out there.
Let's do just some nuts and bolts. So
yeah.
Out Youth is super exciting. We wish there was an Out Youth in every city.
Yes.
And so hooray for Austin. And it's been around since 1990s, like 30 years.
Correct.
And
yes.
That's a big deal. And for context, the AIDS ribbon is 1992.
Yeah.
So when we look back at something like having an organization for young people in particular. Mm-hmm. Austin still doesn't have a gay and lesbian center.
Correct.
There's several really great gay and lesbian organizations, but not a center like some cities. But we do have this for youth.
Right.
And we've had it since 1990. Mm-hmm. How long have you been with Out Youth?
Yeah, so I've been back as their clinical director since November of 2015. I actually did my internship at Out Youth when I was getting my master's degree in counseling at the Seminary of the Southwest, and that's kind of a funny story too, but I'm glad, yeah, let's talk about kind of, I'm standing on the shoulders of a lot of amazing elders, and just the fact that we started in 1990 blows my mind.
That's crazy.
On a daily basis. And I love to tell this story too, that when they started Out Youth, it was some social work students at the University of Texas. And in order to advertise safely, they would go to the Austin Public Library and they would find any sort of, at that time, primarily gay and lesbian literature that they may have had or books, and they would slip flyers into those books. But they would also go to the dictionary, and where the entry for gay was, they would slip flyers into the dictionaries as well, which is just, and I mean, because this was before the internet, like well before the internet.
Right.
And so, but they found a community and they gathered in living rooms for a long time, just to provide that kind of peer support. And we've changed a lot over the years, but we still have that aspect of, we still run groups at our drop-in center on Wednesday and Sunday nights that kind of have that peer support model. And I think that's a really important piece of what we do, is we just help youth find a space and a community where they can be authentically themselves.
Just creating community. I have a friend whose daughter takes advantage of some of the services of Out Youth. And she has just been able to, I think, my words, but his description, she's been able just to find her general freak flag, you know, that she find a place where she can be not just queer, but unusual.
Yes.
And that there's a safe place to do that. But tell us more about what, so there's the drop-in, there's clinical services, which really means counseling, and then some social services. What else does Out Youth offer right now?
Yeah, so one program I'm pretty proud of is our school-based services program, because one thing we noticed is that our drop-in center is such an incredible resource, and we're so lucky to have it in Central Austin. And sometimes we have kiddos and families who find us who live in Wimberley and who live in Killeen and who live in, you know, the far south suburbs of Austin.
And that's that could be as Killeen is like an hour out from outside of Austin.
Yeah. I've had a client who has driven to see me pretty much for weekly therapy from Killeen.
Wow.
Like for 3 years.
And also for some geographical context for people that aren't from Austin, when you get, if you go some directions towards San Marcos, it's pretty much suburbs through and through, especially in the past few years. But you head out another direction or towards Wimberley and you're in sudden rural Texas.
Yes.
So even though you're close to Austin, it's a different culture, a different climate.
Very much.
So having Out Youth is, for a lot of people, going to be worth making the trip.
Correct. Yep. Yes. And so, and that's amazing for kiddos who maybe are out to their families have a car, they have the economic resources to bring them to the drop-in center. But what we were really noticing is that we were having a lovely and fairly diverse crowd at the drop-in center, but not as diverse as we would have liked, especially in terms of race and ethnicity. So we looked around and we noticed too that we just didn't have a ton of physical space at our drop-in center. So we thought, like, how can we maximize the number of young people that we see and we serve? It's by bringing the services to them. So our school-based services program had always been a little bit around, like on a limited basis, but we've been able to grow that program significantly. And so we partner with communities and schools in Central Texas, which is a beautiful organization that, you know, is really focused on providing support so youth kind of stay in school and, you know, academically are able to perform and don't drop out. But they also end up becoming de facto, like, support system for a lot of kids.
And the name is?
Communities in Schools.
Communities in Schools.
Yes. And so They serve primarily Title I schools. So Title I schools are primarily communities where I believe the definition is 70% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch. So Communities and Schools primarily serves those communities, maybe exclusively. So being able to partner with them was really, really important because they gave us access to the campus and they had kind of boots on the ground to know like which youth might benefit from our services. And so for the past several years, we've been building a program where we provide primarily psychoeducational support groups. And this coming fall, we're going to be in at least 13 schools and maybe 14, which is really, really exciting.
That's incredible.
So, yes. And those, you know, those students just are hungry for that community. They're hungry for those services. They're hungry for that, you know, connection. Because on some of these campuses, it varies, but the kind of climate for queer and trans students is not always super friendly. And I think being able to bring services to the people who need it the most is incredibly important.
And that was kind of the story you were telling. If you're out to your family, if you have a car, you start to get a more and more narrow field.
Correct.
Because even if you're a person of means, doesn't mean your family is safe to be out to. And so now that you're in schools, this is a place where someone can show up and get the support that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And this is particularly important. It strikes me as particularly important because we still see suicide rates for queer and trans at about 25%, mm-hmm. as last I checked.
Yeah.
So regardless of what we think about providing queer spaces for people, if we're keeping them alive, we can argue about gay later,
mm-hmm.
but let's just keep kids alive. And so this is actually really significant to be in places where people can find that kind of support.
Yes, 100%.
That's incredible. And 14, almost 14 schools here,
yes.
in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge culture shift. What was exciting for me this year is at Pride,
mm-hmm.
the school district, Austin School District, mm-hmm. had a gay marching band.
Correct.
I was blown away. This is not the high school that I went to, you know.
Like,
this
me neither. Yes, it's huge change, huge change.
Mm-hmm. And OutYouth plays a big part in that now, mm-hmm. apparently, mm-hmm. by being there. So you had mentioned, what else do you do? What else am I missing about what OutYouth does?
Sure.
In schools, drop-in center,
yep.
peer support, counseling.
Mm-hmm. So we have another program that I'm really excited about that's a couple of years old at this point. Where we partner with the Kind Clinic here in town. So the Kind Clinic is a relatively new clinic, but they provide pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. And I spent some time earlier in my career.
Also known as PrEP.
PrEP, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So I spent some time earlier in my career in the HIV field. So I just had a lot of connections and knew a lot of people and knew some folks over at Kind. And so they do sexual health and wellness, with PrEP sort of being the centerpiece, because they're really passionate about bringing that particular medication to the community. Very smartly, in terms of like reaching folks who maybe weren't naturally coming or being a point of access, they realized that to have trans-identified folks come and seek services was very important to them. And they thought the best way to do that was by meeting the community's needs. How about that? So, what? Which is very exciting. And so they kind of went on a journey, and we, you know, had a role in conversation and providing technical support on that journey of starting a gender care aspect of their clinic. So providing hormone replacement therapy, which is incredibly, incredibly valuable. For not all folks who identify as trans, but for a good majority, because it's a great way to treat dysphoria. So we had those conversations, and we really talked a lot about them having an informed consent model, which basically means that if you are a trans person who decides you want to pursue hormone replacement therapy, and you are an adult, you can make a decision in consultation with a healthcare provider about what you want to do with your body. This does not seem revolutionary to me, but I mean, historically, what has been in place has been a real gatekeeper system with the mental health community. So Typically, mental health providers have to see a client, say, often like a cisgender provider, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. And cisgender means somebody who just does not identify as non-binary or trans.
Correct.
And I want to say just because in another interview in this season, I think I quickly and incorrectly identified cis as the opposite of trans, and that's not quite correct. That's another binary. So cis means... if there's a shorthand for it, means not trans or any on that spectrum.
Right.
So someone who's in the mental health field, who does not identify as trans, is the gatekeeper for people who show up and say, they may go to a doctor and say, I think I may be trans, and they're then sent to a cis mental health provider who then says, let's talk about your gender dysphoria.
Yes.
And treats it as a illness, and then that's what they have to go through in order to get things like hormone replacement from there.
Yes.
So what you're describing to us then is now someone can go to the KIND clinic and see a medical professional and or a general practitioner or whatever kind of, as opposed to a mental health medical professional.
Yes.
And be put on hormone treatment.
Correct.
So this is, you're right, there's kind of obviousness to it, but when you start to talk about what it has been, that's a very different story. So that's what KIND Clinic is doing, and you're connected to that, or OutYouth is connected to that.
Yes. So we really, just from our own experience, you know, working with, you know, adolescents certainly, but we've always served young adults at OutYouth as well. And so, you know, we would have some 21-year-olds or 22-year-olds coming to us and saying, hey, I've really been on this journey and thought a lot about this since the age of 12. And I know this is something that I'm ready for. And for me as a provider, like having to have somebody like prove their transness to me just does not feel good. And I just think it's not a great system. And so we really, in consultation with KIND, said, you know, can we try this informed consent model while we will also be here if people want mental health support during that process. So kind of flipping that script a little bit where, you know, people who, you know, want to seek this particular medication can do so. And then by their choice, if they want to also see a counselor, like we are there to provide that particular service. So it's been a really exciting program for us. And just on the community piece, I think my favorite part of this program, I mean, there's a lot of aspects to it. We're at clinic. We talk to every single person who comes to receive gender care, and we tell them about the services that we offer, which is lovely. We do provide individual counseling for people who elect to have individual counseling, but we also have a support group on Tuesday night. And we started just having one support group, and we literally ran out of chairs. Like, we just could not. We didn't have enough space. Like, so we were having like 25 to 30 people show up every single Tuesday for a support group. And so we ended up breaking that into two just because of the demand. And it's just been like such a lovely community that has grown out of that. And we've had some like natural peer leadership that has emerged from that particular program. And now we have a social event twice a month on Mondays. Just this coming Friday, we're really excited. It's my favorite event. It's our second annual. We have a trans and non-binary swim night where we're able to rent out a pool from the city of Austin and people show up. And we had 176 people show up for this event last year. We've got just as many registered this year. And it's just, it was a spiritual experience, I would say, like being there last year and just seeing people feel so comfortable to be with their community. But also, you know, it's for some folks, if you are trans identified and you have physical or body dysphoria, being able to go swimming is really challenging because you feel like you're going to be judged or you can't express yourself the way that you want to in terms of, you know, swim attire. And so it was something I'd heard from clients over and over again. And, you know, we live in Texas, it's hot. Like, and to imagine
swimming's sort of a thing around
it's
here.
It's kind of important. So to be able to offer the swim night is just also one of my favorite things because I think that
that's incredible.
Yeah, that community and to see other people and be seen is just, it's really healing.
Because I think what makes that powerful is when I see the other side of that is that if I identify as trans, if maybe I've started hormones. Mm-hmm. My body changes. Mm-hmm. I may have different hair if I'm taking testosterone. Uh-huh. I may develop breasts mm-hmm. if I'm taking hormones moving towards being a female, mm-hmm. Presenting as female. Mm-hmm. And that means you can never go swimming in a way that may not attract attention yes. in a public situation.
Right.
That means friends' houses. Mm-hmm. That means public pools. Mm-hmm. That means Barton Springs, which is really important to everybody who lives in Austin.
Right, totally.
So that it's providing this one night is not just a great party. It may be the only day out of the year someone mm-hmm. can go swimming and not think about their difference.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's where it becomes much more of a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And now, we don't do much apologetics here in this podcast. It's not what this point is. But mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of people who, in their minds, be very progressive people. Mm-hmm. And again, look, I am gay. I've been part of I've been out for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm from Southern California, so there was an active gay community where mm-hmm. I grew up. And my thinking about trans has radically shifted in just the past few years.
Yeah.
Because just because the letters are up against each other doesn't mean the communities are or right. the experiences are. Mm-hmm. And so I know that there's probably a lot of people going like, oh, I'm really uncomfortable with mm-hmm. us providing trans services for youth mm-hmm. or making these things readily available without more gatekeeping or jumps. As if, and I think that, and I've had close friends mm-hmm. who've said things like, I just don't want people on a whim mm. going down and mm. suddenly making a decision and doing something that maybe irreparable or have medical consequences that we haven't thought through. Mm-hmm. Help us out. Why is this not helpful thinking or what's going on there?
Yes. So many things. And this is a topic and I'm so glad you asked the question and it comes up a lot. And I guess I'll start by saying I just did a presentation with a good friend of mine who's a seminarian at the Seminary of the Southwest and who is openly trans. And we did a presentation at St. David's Episcopal Church, which is my home church, about gender and sexuality. And a question came out of that conversation because we wanted it to be a conversation and discussion and for people to feel safe to ask those types of questions. And a parishioner who I know and love asked, you know, I was hearing recently this interview with Alison Bechdel of the Bechdel test. Yeah, famous kind of feminist mm-hmm. thinker.
We'll put a link to what the Bechdel test is in the notes.
Oh, great. Podcast. Yeah. That's a good thing to link to for sure. So Alison Bechdel was saying, you know, when I was younger, I really did tend towards what people culturally think of as more masculine presentation. I want to always put masculine yeah. and feminine in quotes, just because yes. that's what I do. But what we socially think of as more masculine. And I guess in this interview, Alison was saying, well, like, I wonder, like, if I would have grown up now, like, if people would have thought I was trans or if I would have thought I was trans and what that would have been like for me. And I actually heard a very similar story from Phoebe Waller-Bridge. So the person who created Killing Eve, like, was very masculine, kind of leaning and presenting as a child. But then once she hit puberty, she was like, I'm cis. My sex assigned at birth matches my gender identity. And so the question was, like, is that a danger? Like, is there, you know, a risk of, you know, people, because it's so much more in the cultural consciousness now, thinking they're trans when they're not. And so the way I responded to that question is not perfect, but I think to me, that indicates more that the gender binary is really helpful for no one.
Hmm.
So what I mean by that
yeah.
is a lot of things. I mean, the gender binary is not necessarily helpful for a cisgender woman like myself moving through society and facing misogyny and not making as much money, frankly, as, you know, people who are, you know, more male identified. The gender binary is not helpful for a little boy who may be cisgender who is told not to cry, right? And I don't think the gender binary is helpful for those of us in the queer community who may play with gender norms or explore those gender norms and may be bullied for that by our peers.
When we come back, we'll move from the
Sarah's passionate about to her own story. Stick with us.
Aha, I have good news, everybody. I'm actually going to be giving away a t-shirt, a tote bag, a mug, actually an item of your choice, anywhere from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from Doug Thy Neighbor, the store on Etsy, where you can go to just at etsy.com/shop/Doug Thy Neighbor. All you have to review, any review that you give, just put in a little bit of information, click a star, and I'm going to be choosing one randomly selected, not based on your review, randomly selected review each week through August and into September, and you'll receive one item, again, either from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from the Doug Thy Neighbor store. So don't forget to review. That's all you got to do. And then I will click on it and be in touch with you, and we will send those off to the winners, but you have to review to do it. Ah.
This is Doug Harrison. Welcome back to The Heartburn.
The other thing I want to say about this idea of, well, maybe people or youth especially think they might be trans and they actually aren't, is the gender affirmation process and does not happen overnight. It's not like one day a kid wakes up and says, hey, I'm trans, and then magically poof, like they are able to move forward with becoming their authentic self instantly.
Yeah.
Like that's just not how it happens. Like that's not how it works. So I think the typical process doesn't exist, A. But the thing I've experienced the most clinically is because we start surveying youth at 12, the onset of gender dysphoria. So just to quickly define gender dysphoria, it's basically discomfort or incongruence between your sex assigned at birth and who you know yourself to be in your head. So your gender identity. And it can take a lot of forms. It can be physical. I think that's the most easy thing for people sometimes to understand. So if you're assigned female at birth and you feel like you are more masculine, you may start to have discomfort with your chest, for example. But it can also be social dysphoria. So if, you know, other people around you are perceiving you in a way that doesn't match with who you really know you are, that can also be incredibly distressing.
And this is, if I can, because this feels really important to me, the word dysphoria.
Yes.
And talking about the word match. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between someone in an afternoon thinking they might be curious what it is to be like someone of a not their gender that they understand at that moment.
Right.
A thought is different than dysphoria.
Uh-huh.
Dysphoria is, there's some clarity with that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not in how we're able to talk about it. And that's why social services are important. It's why support communities are important.
Right.
But if I'm experiencing this either socially or just inside my head, this is a pervasive and substantial experience of really not matching. So when I look at my body, it does not match. And that a lot of people even have a great deal of disdain.
Yes.
At a very young age. For the way that their body is. Some even before puberty. Just really seeing their body not match what's in their head.
Absolutely. And I will say two quick caveats before I move forward. One is that I think I've said this, but I am a cis person. And so I say this to every client I sit down with. I own that. And I say, you know, I'm a cis person. I work primarily with trans clients in my clinical practice. I'm married to a trans person. It doesn't mean I know what it is to be trans. And I never will. And so, and I have an incredible amount of privilege moving through the world because transphobia is real, real. It is very real. And so I think that's important for me to distinguish before I move forward. And I want to say I never want to, you know, speak for the community. And I'm really just wanting to speak from kind of my clinical perspective.
Thank you. And again, like what it in these conversations that we're having here, what we want to get at is really what you're passionate about, why you're passionate about it, what drives you. And so this is not, we're not answering all the questions that somebody needs to know. We are going to have links for people to hear about people's trans experiences, to hear it directly from trans people. But what we know for today, and I think that before we go too far even into that, homophobia is still
significant.
Yes.
Misogyny is still really significant. Uh-huh. So when you start talking about transphobia, mm-hmm. we really are talking about not theoretically life and death. And that right now, if you are a trans woman of color,
yes.
your chances of being murdered and your murder not being solved or even tried to be solved mm-hmm. is significant. It's yes. a statistic. It's about one a week mm-hmm. in the States right now. Mm-hmm. Well, considering how small of a portion of the population it is to be mm-hmm. a trans woman of color, mm-hmm. this is a significant health problem. It's a safety risk to all human beings. Mm-hmm. And so, and again, we'll have some of that material. So when people are having this experience, and it's not as if, this is a whimsical thought that I'm having because it may put their lives at risk to right. just speak it out loud, especially yes. in Texas.
Totally, 100%. And that's the thing that I try to express to folks is that, you know, this is a tricky thing to say. And I want to say, you know, again, if you've met one trans person, you've met one trans person. Like, everybody's experience is certainly different. And, you know, people's thoughts and feelings about their own trans identity can be different. But I will say, I've had plenty of youth who come to me at, let's say, 13 or 14. And A, they've been thinking about this and really noticing discomfort and having some mental health effects from that particular dysphoria discomfort for a while. Maybe they haven't articulated it to too many people, but they've been thinking about it for
a long time.
Yes.
Right. In this culture, by the time it's spoken out loud to just about anybody, it's probably been processed quite a bit.
Correct. Yes.
Because as a gay person,
yes.
and even as this culture changed, if mm-hmm. I go, I think I might be gay, I'm aware of the risks that that takes. Mm-hmm. And that even to say that to a close friend might put that relationship at risk mm-hmm. still today.
Yes.
It, just because it's 20 years after Will and Grace mm-hmm. doesn't mean there's not a lot of internalized weirdness
yes.
for this. So to be trans right now, there's probably some clarity there.
Yes, absolutely.
And by the time people get there, mm-hmm. they are probably also in desperate need of some social support. So by the time they're sitting in a chair near you
uh-huh.
at Out Youth, that there's some desperation in there
yes.
to just have someone know. And uh-huh. that's where enter Sarah mm-hmm. and Out Youth. Mm-hmm. And this moves us back on track to, and thank you for helping us with a lot of, there's so much more to know, and we will put up some posts.
Yes.
And we are also, I'm reaching out to some of my trans friends to see if they will also come and be with us at the podcast and great. Share their experience.
Yes.
But that's where people are when mm-hmm. they show up in Sarah's life. Right. And this is something obviously you talk a lot about. It's uh-huh. a good deal of your ongoing experience. Uh-huh. You are also involved with the Central Texas Trans Health mm-hmm. Co-op, mm-hmm. yes? Mm-hmm. And the Trans Wellness Program at Out Youth
right.
is one of your main things. So tell us, and luckily when they get there, obviously they're sitting with Sarah, who's pretty passionate about this. Like, how did this happen, Sarah?
How did it happen? Yeah. Oof. Well, I think this is a weird way to start to answer this question, and I don't want to go this far back because, as you can probably already tell, I could talk forever. But I recently watched the movie Eighth Grade, the Bo Burnham movie.
I have not seen it.
No. Okay, so Eighth Grade, in a nutshell, basically follows the experience of one eighth grader in the last week of that middle school experience who feels very isolated, and just it really nails the like awkwardness and loneliness and just the difficulty of that time of life. And it was just really powerful. And I like cried through the second half of the movie, which was really, really surprising to me. I'm like, like the therapist in me is like, maybe I got some stuff there that I haven't thought about in a minute. And it was funny because
I just see you in the movie theater saying, and how do I feel about that?
Yes, indeed. Luckily, I was on my couch. So it's streaming on Amazon Prime, which we have mixed feelings about. But anyway, so if you want to see Eighth Grade, I highly recommend it, even though it was just, heart-wrenching in a lot of ways. And it was interesting because after that experience, I was thinking about this picture of me, like a school picture that was from sixth grade, I believe. So it was my first year of middle school. And I was remembering I had this like mushroom head haircut. So I have naturally curly hair. And so it was like, you know, pretty short and pretty poofy. And I remember in that picture, I wore this blazer from the Gap that I really loved. That was like this it was like a green, like military green and like yellow, like plaid type of blazer situation going on. And I remember loving that blazer. But I remember looking back at that picture and being like, how did that child not know she was queer? Like, how did I not see that? And I think, you know, as I reflect back, I think just looking at like kind of my adolescence forward and my own process of identity formation, that was in some ways delayed compared to some of the youth that I'm able to work with at the Drummond Center now. Because I grew up in a fairly conservative context, rural Northeast Ohio, and nobody at my high school was out. Nobody. Strangely enough, I seemed to find the other queer people, particularly, as far as I know still, like a couple of cis gay men were pretty present in my life during that time. And I just think it's so interesting looking back that there was like this weird attraction or like coded community that, you know, maybe brought us together, even though, you know, none of us were disclosing things. And I think I was very unaware at that point, what was going on with my sexuality in particular. And it really took me until my early 20s to kind of come into that. And so I think, and this is something we joke about a lot at Out Youth, and I think as long as there's awareness around it, it's okay, but often, and it's totally fine, but a lot of times people like want to volunteer at Out Youth, but we do get a sense that it's because they're like trying to work through some of their own stuff, yeah, like some of their trauma from not having that kind of space when they were younger. Because very few of us have, because I think in the queer community, we have micro generations.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
So even people who are like maybe 5 years younger than me and I'm 38, like maybe they also didn't have anybody who was out in their high school, or maybe they did, like maybe people were starting to, depending on where they were, you know? So I think that's a piece of, I think that passion. And then I think I've also just kind of built my career on just real questions of like justice and injustice. I started my career with Teach for America, which I have some mixed feelings about, quite honestly. So I was an English teacher in South Louisiana at a pretty under-resourced school. Mm. And I think as problematic as some of the, I'm just going to name it, like almost white savior vibes that, you know, at its worst kind of could be a part potentially of that program, I think it really did give me a much deeper understanding of poverty. And it really gave me a sense of the system is rigged.
Yeah.
And this is not a matter of individual responsibility, which, you know, just growing up in a capitalist society in the 80s with a parent who grew up in poverty but was really able to, like, you know, get out of that place. But he's a white cis man, you know, but sort of just slowly realizing, you know, the systemic issues that contribute to things like economic and educational injustice. I think that was super valuable for me. And then moving into the realm of HIV work, which was around the time where I was really coming to understand my own identity. I was doing training and education for HIV professionals and folks working with substance use. I think some of the same stuff was just reinforced. So this idea of, you know, there's a lot of systemic injustice that perpetrates stigma. So in a basic way, homophobia, transphobia, racism is not a person to person. It's not an interpersonal issue. It's a systemic issue. And so I feel like in our own way at Out Youth and the work that I try to do every day, we try to have some kind of interpersonal balm on that experience that people are coming in to the door with living in the society we live in, especially now, while also thinking about, are there ways that systemically we can influence what's going on and kind of the root problem that we see.
So I want to flip sort of hear what you're saying, and the opposite, what we would be talking about if this weren't the case, if you weren't there, is that there can be people who go through life as queer, specifically as trans, as, and again, there's this intersectional hotspot of being a trans person of color is a dangerous place to live. And never, this is unlikely, but theoretically someone could have everybody be just fine with that and still have nothing but hurdles in life and really suffer because of the systemic problems. So it's not always just about, well, I have no problem with you being trans. Like I've had the experience well into my adulthood. Here I am, I just turned 48. And in a conversation, I can come out to someone and people go, I'm fine with that. And which is funny because I wasn't really asking someone's opinion, but I just hear, you know, we know that there's a culture now where you're supposed to be okay with people being gay, even if you're not. So that's the climate has changed for the better there. But that doesn't mean that this is, that there's a matter of justice at work here. That still I have hurdles to face, that's problems. I'm still not seen in certain ways. I'm still not allowed in certain circles. And this can go for take your pick for any number of different identities. And so what happens then when they come to Out Youth, what you're hoping is on one level to just ameliorate some of the initial pain and to provide that safe space, some peer support. But that alone isn't the fix. There is other systemic work where we have to go and say, no, we do need things like protections. This is a thing that is a concern. Again, this is not an issues podcast, but here in Texas, there are lots of laws and laws that are governing other laws about whether I can be fired or whether if my car breaks down in a small town in Texas and I have a rainbow flag on it, can the entire town refuse to house, feed, and service my car? And people that want to protect the right for them not to. So this is a systemic problem, and that sometimes it's couched in language that says, no, this isn't about gay. We have no trouble with you being gay. We just want you to be able to starve to death on the side of the road if something goes wrong. So Out Youth does, and I think some of the creating a community does make a systemic difference because you're creating a community that then acts together to fight those things as But also some direct stuff. What does Out Youth do that takes those things on? Just a couple of things. I don't want to get too, again, too far into it, but.
So briefly, I was just talking about this with my partner last night. So I've like blocked it out, but not this past legislative session in Texas, but the session before, there was something referred to as the bathroom bill that was being debated very actively.
And a hot issue across the country.
So this idea of policing, you know, trans, gender non-conforming, non-binary people's ability to pee, to, you know, perform a basic function. And so Out Youth, our staff, and some of the youth who we, you know, try to prep and provide, you know, emotional support for, went to the Capitol twice and testified. And it was just, I'm still processing that experience because some of the lawmakers and they're, I want to be generous, but it's hard.
Naivete?
Some of the, or just like absolute refusal, like emotionally, intellectually to actually engage was shocking to me. Like I just, I felt like I had like any like naive faith I had in, you know, folks' ability as lawmakers in particular to have the greater good in mind or be open to hearing opposing points of view from their own or from those of their constituents was just completely kind of taken away. At the same time, I think what was cool and amazing about that experience was just seeing the community, the beautiful community, just come out in droves and sit there for hours and hours and hours. I mean, the testimony the first time, it went until like 4 a.m. Because so many people had signed up. And I would say that at least 90% of those folks were speaking out against the bathroom bill. And just to see like the humor that people use, like, I think that's something great. And I don't want to generalize, and, you know, all parts of our community are different and unique, but I think our ability to have a sense of humor and just be resilient just blows my mind. So one very brief example is the person who was running the hearing, who frankly clearly wasn't listening, like, had the sniffles that day. And so one person who testified, like, in a way that, you know, was maybe to like be sweet, but also was like kind of throwing shade, like, handed her some Kleenex, which was just really funny. And then proceeded like in the testimony just to be lovely and generous and just spoke from the heart and their own experience. And I think, yeah, just that's the benefit of advocacy and activism and trying to make systemic change, is that it's important, A, but B, I think it just brings the community together and highlights some of the beauty and the strength that people bring to the table.
And even as you're talking, though, I'll be honest, there's a little sliver of me that's exhausted.
Oh, yeah.
Because just to, when you say bathroom bill, I even get nervous because there's going to be people listening to this podcast again. People are all
totally.
There's a lot of different reasons people are going to want to listen to this podcast.
Sure.
And some of you who are listening are going to feel very differently about some of the issues that we've talked about so far, to an extreme degree. Mm-hmm. But part of what we value here is just listening.
Yeah.
But even as soon as we hit a culture war issue, mm-hmm. and we raise that, I get so tired because I can hear entire scripts of the conversations and the rehearsed sound bites that we get through before we actually get into a real conversation of two people sitting together and talking about it, which is, again, part of the reason that we want to talk not just about what these issues are, what Out Youth is doing, what you're passionate about, but when we talk about those flip sides, like, if you can imagine, I know that this is a hot bill. So far, there's been no one that has ever, by posing as a trans person, taken advantage of the things. If we can imagine the experience of somebody who genuinely is non-binary and does not present either clearly as masculine or feminine, there is no restroom to use.
Right.
None. Without being at risk.
Totally.
So there is violence risk. There is risk in people's health concerns. There's risk of people peeing themselves in public. And there's not a risk on the other side, and this becomes a hot issue. And yet, getting to the point of listening, and this, I think, exposes some of the transphobia. Why is all this important to talk about? Well, I think just because it draws attention to the trans issues, but also it draws us back to, come on, Sarah, what an issue to be passionate about. I mean, you're really stepping in it into an exhausting life. I mean, you've chosen to be somewhere that is exhausting, and to there is something of a beautiful, I don't want to say an elephant in the room, but except for I love elephants, so it works. You've said seminary and St. David's Episcopal Church a couple of times.
Yeah.
Come on now. Do you mean to tell me? I mean, I'm making this setup wrong because, I mean, again, this is a gay Christian person hosting a podcast.
Right.
But how on earth do you be a person of faith and so active in the trans community? That seems like an oxymoron to, again, even progressive people who feel fine with people being trans. This seems strange.
Yes. It seems strange to me sometimes too, quite frankly. Like, and so,
You may have noticed I've done very little editing in this particular episode and in the next one, because so much of what Sarah has to say is important, and so many of my questions really help open up her wisdom and as she addresses so many parts of them. If you're curious at all as to how she works out the work she does with her faith and her spirituality, well, then you're going to have to listen to the next episode. I promise it's even better than this one, maybe by leaps and bounds. What a remarkable woman. If you want to know more about the work she does, go to outyouth.org. If you want us to know what you think about this episode, please go to theheartburn.net and leave a voice message for us there. And please, again, share and subscribe and review on new podcasts that make or break. My name is Doug Harrison, and this has been The Heartburn.